Joe Beaver Show is on the air.
For years, there were forebodings, but did the powers that be pay enough attention?
We're on the eve of destruction.
And then it happened, gradually and suddenly.
We finally really did it. You maniacs! You blew it up!
The why and the wherefore of the destruction continues to be well documented, but the more pressing question now, of course, is... The answer to that existential question is not fully known, but what is known is that Beaver Nation carries on, speaking as one through it all.
Been in trouble, but I'm okay. Been through the ringer, but I'm okay.
We're strong enough to take it. We can make it.
And we have made it, at least one more time, to another edition of the Joe Beaver Show. On 1240 Joe Radio, KEJOAM.com, and 93.7 FM.
It, you know, and that's one of the things that you'd like there to be. I don't know if it's more uniformity. Easier, you know, more user-friendly accessibility.
This is
referring
common.
To the website.
This is common, usually in the non-conference.
Yeah, and this would be a non-conference game as it once was.
Right, right. The bigger the school, the more they are apt to do what Oregon State does with certain communications releases. Some of the medium to lower schools, they don't necessarily do releases, but they'll write a release story, put a few facts and figures then in, and then that's it, and offer a printer-friendly version.
Right.
But they don't usually in a release that you see from Oregon State or above, let's say, they have stats, facts, figures, rosters, bios, everything you can think of. Like almost like, and then the bigger, really bigger schools with bigger budgets, like a Nebraska or you know the big blue bloods, where they have 20 Hank Hagers instead of just one, then they'll just they'll make a book every week for every game. But
well, anyway, the Pepperdine Waves website does have game notes, but it takes a little maneuvering. It's not easily locatable, but they do exist because I was reading them on my phone. We're looking now to kind of get a printed version out for several reasons. One is, even though I've already done all of the stats and the roster recognition and name pronunciation and those sorts of things, and have conducted interviews with assistant coach Chris Haslam and Wayne Tinkle, with one more still to do as soon as the show's over, race back into Corvallis, get to the end of shoot around and grab a player, probably Johan Munch, who made a nice contribution in the USF game. And as seasons go, you hope to end up talking to every player on the roster at some point. And Mike Ratai is a guy you could talk to after almost every game, or Polo Minor or Parsa. But Johan getting an opportunity to play, blocking a couple of shots, showing some confidence on offense, I thought was kind of one of the highlights in an otherwise disappointing night at USF Saturday. So Johan, who we have had on before, we're kind of in the stage of the season now where we've had everybody on at least once, and we then kind of follow game stories to see, okay, what player would best be best fit the player profile portion of our pregame show. So we'll have a chance to talk to Johan tonight. Now, one of the other features in the pregame show that is curious to me is the Holland-America matchup. Jimmy Wilson really likes it, and you have to, if you find a feature, a sponsored feature, that the broadcast, here we go, let's use that term again, that the talent, the broadcast talent
Got to give a title somewhere.
Yeah, he is excited about it. And Jim always, whenever Jim and I talk during the course of a week during football, whatever team we may be playing, Jim says, now, Doc, on the Holland America, what game do you want to highlight? And he's already thinking about matchups that the Beavers have had in football with other teams. And he said, I want to talk about the game at San Diego State where the Beavers trailed going into the fourth quarter and Steven Nelson had a pick six and, you know, that, whatever. He'll have a detail ready to go for the Holland America matchup. Now, tonight, when I get to that portion of the pregame show, and our pregame shows are very tight, it's a 6:32 tip. So that means we can
celebrate. Get 2 extra minutes.
It's interesting. No, it's not too. Usually, though, in the past, it's 5 extra minutes. The Gonzaga game, for example, was a thing of beauty. That thing tipped at 8:15, I believe, by the time we finally got there.
Yeah.
And that's a sweet amount of time to let everything breathe. Well, tonight, with a 32-minute, you know, we go on at 6, the tip at 32. Everything's on a fast track, even to the point, and I got mad at my producer, who has, he likes to have fun. I speak not of Shacker. I speak not of Joey Kieran. I speak of Dylan Barishon, who is one of a trio of engineers, and we're grateful to have engineers, and take the pressure off of us to try to hook up the gear. And in baseball, we're on our own. We're our own engineer, and that always adds that little level of anxiety. Why I end up in a payphone at Jackie Robinson Stadium, because the equipment's not working, and I've got a ball game to call and don't really have the time or inclination to want to be chasing down technical issues when there's a game to broadcast. So we're grateful to have engineers. Now, Dylan has the bright idea he said, Mike, I know we're tight on time, so there's some sort of app or whatever you can use, some sort of effect to speed things up a little bit. So we're talking to Parso Fala tonight on our pregame show. Parso, you had a big ball game last night. You seemed to establish the low post very well. How'd you do that compared to, seemed like you took a big step in that direction.
Have you done that?
He did that the other day at USF. He played the player profile interview without telling me that he'd done it.
Through
I put the
app?
Headset on. So there was some sort of filtering effect.
Was it that pronounced?
And it was JoJo Lake coming off a big game against Gonzaga. JoJo, what was it like to be in that game?
You
know,
so
it's
you
kind
could
of
tell.
How it sounded. And I just immediately took the headset off and said to Dylan, Dylan, did you speed that up? And he goes, yeah, because we're tied on time. Yeah, I know, but I don't like it.
No, you can't do that.
And so I said,
it's best to just cut it short.
I said, for the next interviews, can you put us back to real sound? In real time as the interview is recorded, instead of the JoJo Lake, our guest of the pregame show, that type of thing. So I bring all of that up simply to say we're grateful to have producers, engineers. We have less time with the 32 tip, but enough time that I look forward to talking to Johan. I've already talked to Chris Haslam and Dwayne Tinkle and those. Try to keep them fairly brief in nature, but the Holland America matchup comes in the pregame show at some point. There's not a lot of time to dwell on it. But I like when you get to this kind of feature and you get to talk about the biggest game in the history of the Pepperdine-Oregon State series. Let me think at the moment. Kip.
Now you're going to insult people.
I'm trying to think of the 8 or 9 people.
You're going
right
to tell everybody they don't
what
know
game,
anything.
Well, you're never going to play in the NBA, Larry Steele. We're going to have Don.
And I don't like him.
We're going to have Don McLean on at 12:05, who strikes me as kind of on the borderline of a pathological truth teller, like George Karl was. I remember one of my favorite moments in the history of life in basketball, covering the Blazers in the 90s. George Karl brought a really good Sonics team, and I think the team that might have gone 63-19 and then lost to the late, great Dikembe in the first round in Game 5.
Yeah,
I think it might have been that year.
Yeah.
The Blazers had played in the finals in 91-92, and then in 92-93 got out 28-11, and then had a Salt Lake City Mall Marriott Hotel Mall incident with players. And
oh,
from
yeah.
28 and 11, they slipped back and were kind of a mediocre finish, 500 or less ball from that point on. When Magic, I remember Magic Johnson saying, this Blazer team could win the whole thing, referring to the 92-93 Blazers when they beat Utah in Salt Lake City, but it turned out to be an ill-fated trip, and they slipped. Now, the next year then, the Sonics riding high and the Blazers beginning to slip, George Karl comes into town, and after his shoot-around, somebody asked him, what are your impressions of the Blazers this year? And poor George, he can't help himself just in terms of, he said things like this. Well, very veteran, talented team, no question, still a tough out. But you can see they've gotten a little stale. I remember those of us in the media scrum kind of gave it the shooting glances. Dwight might have been there. Mm-hmm. Eggers might have been there. I can't remember, but a bunch of us had microphones in front of George after a Sonic shoot around getting ready to play the Blazers that night. And he's just, they're still talented and tough out, but you can see they've gotten a little stale. Now, wow. That's almost, I know these are grown men. I know these are pros. Mm-hmm. I know that they don't generally, you go running over with bully. Hey, Rick Adelman, did you hear what Carl just said about your team? Clyde, Terry, come here, Buck. Mm-hmm. Did you hear what he just said about you guys? But that's kind of what happened.
Really?
It is kind of what happened. And so when the Blazers had their shooter, hey, George Karl says you guys have gotten a little stale. And I remember.
What was the reaction?
Well, the reaction, it was kind of like, oh, okay.
Oh, really?
And the Blazers went out and beat them soundly that night, which tells me that even grown rear-end men, clean it up. People are always talking about grown men, grown rear-ended men. Vin Scully, the best darn sports show, period. Anyway, grown rear-ended men. Grown men can get motivated. They can get a chip on their shoulder and play with an extra edge when they're dissed like that. And
exactly.
I like that. I like the fact that that existed in 1993. I mentioned Don McLean, like George, who was kind of telling the truth. The Blazers were beginning to slip, and they only won 47 games that year. That era, the Clyde, Buck, Jerome, Terry era, beginning to grind down. They'd had their shot. They got close, but they were getting stale, so to speak. And George says it, but it motivated that Blazer team to sort of reach back, rediscover their fastball for that night and that game, and beat the best team in the NBA that year in the regular season soundly.
There's many teams in the NBA and in other sports nowadays, I think, I would be surprised if they could get motivated, if they care. But
that, whatever, that word, that rivalry, the rivalry between the Blazers and Sonics, all of that came into play.
I missed that,
and the old guys pulled it together like, he can't call us that. We're not that. Let's go show him what stale is.
Hey, bulletin board material is at any level.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it. And I liked it then. I remember liking that result then. Don McLean's got a little bit, and I look forward to visiting with Don. He joins us at 12:05. Al Epstein about to call his 1,213th consecutive Pepperdine game tonight at 12:30. Baseball today with Easton Tolt pushing for a starting outfield spot along with Gavin Turley and Dallas Macias. Easton Tolt had some good moments last year, and it looks like to me he's going to be a guy to make an incremental jump this year to be even more productive, a much more regular part of the lineup, the fastest guy on the team. Easton Tolt today at 11:30. So Tolt, McLean, and Epstein. Don's got a little George Karl in him and a little pathological truth-telling. I think he's still doing the last several years, and we can ask Don himself. He and J.B. Long are working both games this weekend. But Don has kind of a pre-draft camp for draft-eligible players that he conducts and runs in Los Angeles. And it's a kind of a boot camp, trying to get guys ready for the draft and the process and the next level. And an article that I read last year during this process, Don doesn't hold back. And it strikes me a little bit like Mick Cronin, the current coach at UCLA, Don's alma mater. talking about these players are delusional. Mm-hmm. You know, Mick said that of his players. They're delusional about who they think they are, how good they are, or what they are, how hard they're working, whatever else. They're delusional. Now, I'm not sure it's the best of things for Mick to say it and to throw players under the bus on one level. On another, though, he's not afraid, in a sense, to say maybe some things that could or should be said once in a while about the current state of affairs. And Don McLean, in, according to this article and this reporter who observed Don's decorum and demeanor in this boot camp, didn't hold back at all. You're trying to play at the next level, and you let that guy keep you from scoring. You need that. I mean, I like that approach.
Well,
from
in
Don.
In that scenario, in that setting, you have to be. If I'm a player going in, I want to know anything that needs to be worked on before trying out at different camps and getting ready for the draft. He has to be truthful in that scenario.
And he is, apparently.
I mean, that's like Simon Cowell, an American Idol.
Right.
You know, all of these kids grow up and grandmama and mama tell them how great they are when they're horrible. And they tell them, you're honey, baby. Mm-hmm. And then then you get to a contest where you're just not good enough. And the one guy is willing to tell the truth. Says, you know, you're horrible. Now, that's a little harsh, but I don't think Don would be that harsh. You know, and then they go home crying and they put the camera on them and everything. And it's like, you were horrible. There's no way you should be there. Your parents and your grandparents did you a disservice.
I'm interested, too, to ask Don about being a dad and a coach, because he has a son, does Don. He's got several, but he has one that has earned an offer and has committed to West Virginia. So he's a good player.
Wow.
He's in the process of his senior year now in Southern California. Not sure which high school it is, but his son is heading back to play at West Virginia.
Is he eschewing local schools?
A power forward. Is he what?
Eschewing local schools?
Yeah. He's recruited by some decent schools. Mm-hmm. I didn't see UCLA. I didn't see some of the other. I didn't see some of the schools that you might expect. But if he ends up in West Virginia, he's pretty good, and he's a four-star prospect.
Wow!
And I wondered, and I'd be interested in talking to Don. Okay, are you Jimmy Pearsall's dad revisited?
No,
as a dad. Or do you coach your son up like you would the guy at your boot camp? And he might. The answer to that might be, I have to, and he wants me to. You know, it might be. But Don McLean, the conference's all-time leading scorer, Don McLean, and a noted, confident, brash, the word arrogant was thrown about around him during his days at UCLA. That means that he came in to Gil Coliseum, and Gary Payton was on the same floor. So I'm just curious to see how some of those exchanges went. I think Don has touched on it before. But as we visit with Don McLean, who will be calling from the San Ramon Pac-12 Enterprise Studios the next two Oregon State games, Pepperdine and Santa Clara, we'll talk to Don about number of things. I do, too.
He's an outstanding broadcaster.
Yes, he is.
And you can trust him. He says he gives you good analysis. I think he's exceptional. I do remember when he played and when he had that reputation back in the day. But he was good. He was very, very good.
So we look forward to talking to Don about these matters as well as with Easton Tolt and then Al Epstein. But the Pepperdine phenomenon, we're going to take a break now and then we'll come back for a quick segment before we talk to Easton again. So we'll take care of some business right now, another quick segment. I'll come back and for Kip, who knows, and others, we'll touch on, preview, the Hall in America matchup history with Pepperdine because it's one of the great games in Beaver history that comes under that canopy next on the Joe Beaver Show. Because the Hall in America matchup, which we'll have the official read and all of those things tonight during the pregame show between 6 and 6:30. But the Beavers played Pepperdine March 14th in 1982 in Pullman in the NCAA regional second round.
Yeah.
The Beavers defeated Pepperdine 70-51. Danny Evans with 16 points. Lester and Charlie had 14 apiece. The Beavs then defeated Idaho 60-42 to go to the Elite Eight, falling to Georgetown in Provo. But until the 2018-19 season, the last time the Beavers and Waves met, the previous meeting had been March 14th of 82 mm-hmm. in the NCAA tournament in a 70-51 victory for the Beavers over Jim Herrick's Pepperdine Waves to give them the opportunity to then beat Idaho and go to the Elite Eight.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good memory in the Holland America sure. matchup. Jim Wilson and I both would have settled on that had we been working the game together. And I'll do that tonight. And
yeah.
that'll be officially sponsored during the network pregame show later. But that is the biggest meeting, the one with the most at stake and on the line between the two programs that haven't played each other that often. But
yeah,
that was
like,
a big one.
Like a lot of other games, West Coast Conference teams, and even outside of that, the Beavers have just five games in the series with them being close
yeah.
by.
Yeah.
But two of those five were in tournament play.
Let's take a break. We'll come back with Easton Tolt. I'm looking forward to the conversation with a young man. I mean, he did good things last year. But I think better things are ahead, and he's pressing for a job as a starter, an everyday player in the outfield for a loaded Oregon State team in 2025, which is less than a month away, obviously, from getting this highly anticipated season going. Easton joins us next on the Joe Beaver Show. We continue on the Joe Beaver Show. Mike Parker with John Warren, Easton Tolt, our first guest coming up here in a moment. We'll visit with Don McLean at 1205, Al Epstein, the voice of the Pepperdine Ways, 40 years and counting, joining us at 1230. It is, it's amazing to me, but here we are. Baseball is just several weeks away now in the opener yeah. in Surprise.
Valentine's Day.
And the sense of anticipation every year for Beaver baseball, is it always builds. There's always excitement. The fact that you start a new season in the warmth of Arizona, and just mm-hmm. this year, there's a even bigger, to me, bigger than usual sense of, okay, let's get this thing going, because there's so much talent, the expectations are high, and no one dodges or shies away from
them. That's the key, is the coaches don't pull back from that or slow you down.
It's not like, hey, we're taking it just, you know, one game at a time, and we're not thinking about anybody else right now other than, see, I'm not even thinking that. They opened with Xavier in Surprise. But when they get there, they'll take it pitch by pitch, no question. But sure. big picture stuff is sort of what we want to talk about today, as well as just that excitement level building and the anticipation for what the Beavers will be in this 2025 season. And a guy that has been a key contributor in his first two seasons, last year in particular, I think getting ready to make another big jump and pressing his way perhaps as the third starter in the outfield with Gavin Turley and Dallas Macias, has a good shot at that through his talent, his speed, his competitiveness. Easton Tolt joins us on the Joe Beaver Show. Easton, good morning. It's gonna be fun to talk baseball with you here on a cool January day. How excited are you about what's ahead for you and your teammates?
Hey, Mike. Yeah, I mean, I'm super excited. This is a very special team. Happy to be on the show.
Thank you, sir. And what's it been like, Easton, building into this year for you, now a veteran guy in your third year? What's it been like being a guy that now younger guys come in? I mean, you're one of the veteran leaders on the team. Do you embrace that role and look forward to in a very real sense, being a leader on the team this year?
Yeah, I mean, I look at it as when I was a freshman, I had people like Travis, I had people like Brady Casper, and those people really took me under their wings. And to be that guy now for the younger kids and really step into that role, it's really fun, especially with, you know, the adversity that I've been through my freshman year, getting injured and everything, kind of just getting the freshmen and even the transfers into the mix of what college baseball looks like, what college baseball looks like at Oregon State, and just what to expect. It's awesome.
Easton, let me ask you about what I'm sensing, and I'm believing there's a big jump. I mean, you've made incremental jumps in all aspects of your game, but how do you feel right now heading into this year, junior year, about where you are with your game and your expectation about, quote unquote, a big jump this year?
Yeah, I mean, I feel really good. Like Skip said, I've made some big jumps. I mean, the biggest thing for me is the confidence levels that, I've gained throughout the years of, you know, playing against this competition. I'm the most confident I've ever been, and, you know, it comes with finding success on the field in the fall and everything like that. But, yeah, I'm super excited, super confident, and ready to go.
Easton Tault, our guest on the Joe Beaver Show. Anything, baseball and the constant adjustments with your swing and your approach, have you done anything that you would call significant along those lines in terms of your bat and your bat speed and how you approach the craft of hitting?
Yeah, I mean, it's adjustments here and there. I mean, mechanically, I've kind of gotten into the perspective of, you know, you can have a bad swing and still find success on the field. I've gotten blessed with a good swing as well, but I think the main adjustments I've made at the plate are just like mental and really finding my approach at the plate. Travis Bazzana helped me a lot with that. And then just building off of it, you know, what's good for me and what's not good for me as I've found success over the past years. I feel like, I mean, obviously my swing has been good and that's going well as well. Like the adjustments I've made there are really good. But I think the biggest thing, like I said, is just the approach I have at the plate. And then once again, the confidence as well.
Easton Tault joining us. Easton, this is John with Mike. Yesterday, Coach Canham talked a lot about, when asked, of course, about the new facility out beyond center field, how cool it is. But he jokingly said, you guys, you know, go across the street, buy a cot, and stay there. Are you spending a lot of time in that new, brand new hitting facility?
Yeah, I mean, there won't be a time after practice where you don't see me and Dallas and see us in the cages hitting off the machine for 2 hours. I mean, we were there last night from 7 to 9. Hmm. Just hitting off the machine nonstop. We got the new iPitch in there, which is unbelievable technology, simulating real game-like situations. So me and Dallas specifically, I mean, we're in there nonstop before or after practice, anything. I mean, we're trying to be in there as much as possible to, you know, simulate live game experiences and stuff like that.
Good for you. And that type of stuff, Easton, that makes all the difference, doesn't it? That extra time, the extra reps, when nobody necessarily is watching, you don't have big crowds at Goss watching, you know. Do you feel like that's when you're really building something special, Dallas, yourself, and other guys that are taking advantage of that new place?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously during practice, you're getting those feels as well. But with, you know, 20 position guys on the team, you don't necessarily get as many swings as you'd like. And you can really see on the team who, you know, we actually have a high work ethic on the team, so there's a lot of us that do it. But you can definitely see who, you know, who's spending time in the cages and who's not. I mean, we as a team are really good about getting extra swings in. And that makes, yeah, like you said, that makes all the difference.
Easton, we talked with Brad Brown a couple of months ago all about the machines, the different really expensive machines. But it was heavy pitching stuff. What about machines that cost a lot of money and perhaps are in this new facility for hitting? That, I mean, what do they do? Do you have them? What do they? Can they really help you? Is it more than just seeing yourself on video?
Yeah, I mean, the newest one that we recently got that has been super beneficial for the offense is it's called the iPitch. A lot of like really high end facilities use it, like Driveline. Basically, what you can do with it is you can put it at 60.5 feet, which is the exact distance of the mound, to the plate. And then you can change the velo to, you know, you can make it look exactly like, for example, Drew Tolazzo's fastball. You can put it at 92, 93 with, you know, 2100 RPMs. Mm-hmm. So you're simulating not only the speed, but also how the ball is spinning. And then, again, another really cool feature of that machine, you can change the sequences. So it's not only throwing heaters. You can put the ball in the machine, it'll throw a heater, and then it'll automatically change the spinning of the wheels to then throw a slider at 82 with, you know, negative 18 inches of horizontal break. So you're really simulating a live at-bat rather than just playing, okay, I'm going to take one round of fastballs, and then I'm going to try to change the machine manually to throw sliders then. So, I mean, the technology on these things are insane, up to how the ball's moving, the velo, how the ball's spinning, you know, locations, different sequences. It's really simulating like a live at bat during the game.
Well, simulating even to the point, I mean, these are random selections by the machine. Do you put it quote unquote on random, so you're not sure what it's going to give you?
You could do that. Yeah. Mainly what we've been doing recently, we do two heater, two slider sequence. So then you're not just like seeing five heaters in a row and really getting the timing down and really like adjusting pitch to pitch. It's like, or sorry, not getting in a rhythm, mm-hmm. but rather you're getting a slider after two heaters, and then you have to adjust to that, and it's just making pitch to pitch adjustments. And but yes, you can essentially whoever's feeding the machine can, you know, make it so you don't know what's coming and really mm-hmm. simulate a live at bat. Like okay, this is oh, you know, get your approach on oh, and then mm-hmm. say he you know lands a slider 0-1, then whoever's feeding the machine is able to change the pitch, change the location, and really simulate a live at bat.
And with that, you can scout another pitcher, know all of his pitches, put that in, so you literally are having an at bat against a rival pitcher.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, in the fall, I believe it was Leif Palmer that I was getting a live at bat. I was about to take live at bats off of, and I had Gip set up the machine to kind of set up just like Leif's pitches. And obviously, he's my teammate. I don't want to completely destroy his, go mm-hmm. off against him. But no, just like that shows just like, what you can do, the different technology. Yeah. So like you can see a pitcher's arsenal, put their pitches in, and we have all the technology to show their spin rate and horizontal movement and vertical movement that you can put into this machine and really simulate what you're about to face.
Easton Tall joining us on the Joe Beaver Show, getting ready for the Beavers opener in Surprise on February 14th. Easton, that you mentioned learning a lot from Boz, the great Travis Bezzana. I'm just wondering, in the big picture, what he imparted to you, how you learned from him, the approach that he took that you tried to learn from and emulate to some extent.
Yeah, I mean, I can go on and on about how Travis, how he's affected my game. The day I stepped on campus, Travis kind of took me under his wing. Great guy. Definitely the most knowledgeable baseball player I've ever talked to. So, I got to listen and talk about his approach, talk about what he thinks about against a lefty, righty, different counts. And then again, like one of the most athletic people you've ever met as well. So then that's pushing me to be like, okay, like me and him used to bet all the time, like, hey, like next fall, who's going to be faster? What do you think? Like, and I'm obviously it's Travis, but I don't want to beat him. That's just a different level of, him pushing me to be the best I can. And then, he's also super real with you too. So if he thinks you're not giving your all, if he thinks maybe like you're kind of not giving it your all essentially, then he'll tell you and tell you how you need to improve. And then, yeah, I mean, like I said, on the offensive side, he's so knowledgeable. It's not even real. The stuff he will get you to correct and his approach and everything like that is insane to listen to.
Easton, what every year teams are new. You lose guys and you bring new guys in. What is this year's team chemistry? What's its personality? I remember calling, several years of Beaver baseball in the beginning, and there was a 2-year run, and it was back in many of the glory days, 18, 19, 20, when, you guys would just be laughing and playing games in the back of the bus down in Surprise. And taking every game seriously, but you could just tell that you were all really good friends. How do you assess this year's group of guys?
Yeah, luckily we didn't, obviously the guys that got drafted and everything, we didn't lose a whole bunch of guys, and the team camaraderie this year is insane. We have, we kind of have every personality you can think of. We have jokesters, Dawson Santana, Jay Bentrosky. You have serious guys that, at times you need those type of guys. So, I mean, the team chemistry alone, I mean, it's unbelievable. As coach, I listened to coach talk a little bit yesterday. He said it's a team or a player ran team, 100%. Like we have, AJ Singer, we have Wilson Weber talking in the classroom to the team rather than, just all of us listening to Skip every day. It's a different type of respect around the clubhouse this time around that it's like, okay, there's not a single guy I don't trust with essentially my life. Like, these guys are my brothers. It's really a different type of team chemistry this year that it's tough to achieve.
But do you make the freshmen carry things?
No, we don't do any of that. We have a few freshmen that clean up the weight room. Not that we make them necessarily, but few freshmen clean up the weight room. We treat them as everyone else. A lot of them, we have a lot of special talent in the freshman class. And, a lot of them are going to do great things this year, and if not this year, a lot of them are going to do great things next year. So we're trying to, get them up to speed and then also, build a good team chemistry with them too.
A few more minutes with Easton Tault joining us on the Joe Beaver Show. Easton, when you talked about Travis and speed and your own speed and the contests and the challenges to each other, you are blazing fast. Do you expect, you know, we talk about hitting, defense, and important aspects. Speed is so often a difference maker in games, and you have it. You are fast. Do you expect or look forward to or make a goal of that speed of yours to translate into the running game this year a little bit and stealing a few more bags, that type of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about it all the time. I think speed is one of my biggest parts of my game, and I take big pride in being, you know, I would like to say I'm the fastest, mm-hmm. you know, around, you know? So yeah. I take big pride in that, and I work on it, you know, consistently every week, like as much as I can. And in terms of bringing it into the game, I mean, Travis Bedard rewrote the record book of stolen bases, right. Pretty much everything you can think of. But, you know, my goal this year is to take one of those away from him and get that stolen base record.
Nice. I'm glad. That's big.
Do you think Arquette could be a 1-1 guy if things go right?
Did you say Iva?
Yeah.
Yeah, Iva's a special, special talent. I mean, you look at him, he's 6'5", 6'6", and then, again, like you said, no one expected him to come in and be fast, and then you see him running 30s and 20s with everyone, and he's, you know, top three, top five on the team, and it's a different type of talent. He's very, like, you know, back 3 or 4 years ago when you saw Jacob Melton, unbelievable mm-hmm. light tower power, but also, you know, he's stealing 40 bags in the minor leagues now. That's very Iva Arquette-like, where it's like, it's just a unicorn type of player. Stupid power, big guy, and an unbelievable glove at shortstop. Effortless, it's just effortless. And then, you know, the speed alone is insane at that height.
Yeah, well, I'm still trying to get my mind around the size of that kind of size at shortstop. There mm-hmm. aren't many in the history of the game with that kind of frame and build, and I'm excited to see how it all plays out for him and all of you guys. Let's close, Easton, with a thought about, man, you talked about how excited you are and your personal level and your teammates. When I look up and down the roster, the lineup, there's a lot of good talent in it, right, Easton? From an offensive standpoint, your thoughts about what kind of challenges you hope and believe you'll pose for opposing pitchers this year?
I mean, yeah, you look at it and you see that we lost Travis Bazzano hitting 400 with 29, and then Micah McDowell hitting 400 with, you know, however many he hit, 12, I believe, or something like that. And you think it's going to be tough to replace, but, I mean, depth-wise, this lineup is so deep. I mean, there's players that 1 through 9 that are, like, they're unbelievable bat-to-ball guys, power guys. There's not really an at-bat that a pitcher can take off. It's not like, okay, mm-hmm. facing 7-8-9 this inning, you know, take a few miles per hour off or throw a lot of heaters right now, or really take this inning to lock in. No, there's nothing like that in this lineup. I mean, there's going to be people coming off the bench this year in pinch hit opportunities or, you know, defensive replacement opportunities that could be playing, you know, leading off at any other school, you know, in the West Coast or, you know, stuff like that. Like, our depth this year with just everyone is insane to me. The lineup 1 through 9 and the bench guys, mm-hmm. it's going to be a special, special offense this year.
And the arms, too. We'll close with a thought. We've talked a lot about offense, running, et cetera, but you've mentioned Leif Palmer. You've mentioned, you know, maybe other guys and looking at their stuff in iPitch and so on. What about the arms that you've seen, that you've competed against, that you know are going to run out and give you quality innings this year?
Right. Once again, a super, super depthy bullpen this year. Way depth, like, our starting pitching last year was really good and our bullpen was good, but it's done nothing but gotten better. I mean, you have people like Drew Talaz, like I already mentioned, mm-hmm. made huge jumps this year. His fastball is unicorn-like. Mm-hmm. There's people, you know, Dax Whitney could have went in the first round out of high school and chose to come to Oregon State. Great choice. He's going to be one of the best pitchers in the country this year. I mean, he's once again a unicorn fastball, unicorn off speed, and it's just coming down a hill at you. I mean, he's 6'4", 6'5", and it's unicorn stuff. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's the deftiest. Everyone in the line. I mean, Matthew Morrell, just unbelievable. Like 94, 95. I mean, we have 8 to 10 guys that are going to be sitting in the low to mid 90s this year, and we didn't have velo like that in the past. And not to mention, like, velo obviously is very important, but then again, we have all those guys that are going to be high in the velo also have really good off-speed command. They're going to be able to land 0-0 sliders, and you just don't really know what to expect. You can't sit 0-0 fastball against Nelson Keljo, because then he's been working on his slider a lot. I didn't even talk about Nelson Keljo.
Right.
He's going to be an insane, like, top two grounder this year. And, I mean, Eric Segura is coming back from injury, and he's going to be insane. He's played for USA 93-95. I mean, it's just one of the – I can go on and on about our pitching staff. Being a catcher in the past as well, I know a lot about every single guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can go on and on about how depth and how nasty our pitching staff is going to be this year.
Well, Easton, you've given us a lot to think about, to ponder, to be excited about. It's just around the corner. It's always good to talk to you, my man. And thanks for taking time for the Joe Beaver Show. We'll see you soon. I won't be with you in those first couple of weeks, but I look forward to catching up with you down the road and excited for the year ahead and what you're going to be doing as a big part of the lineup. Thanks for making time for us, Easton. It's good talking
thanks,
to you.
Thanks, Easton.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. Go Beavs.
Easton Talt, our guest. Let's break. We've got Don McLean and Al Epstein coming up next hour on the Joe Beaver Show. Well, really enjoyed the conversation with Easton.
Kid.
And the thing I enjoyed, there were many things in the conversation. I appreciated the fact that he's challenged himself to try to break the single season stolen base record. But I like that. And I don't think that means he becomes Maury Wills, who... Maurice Morning Wills, who? Well,
I've heard of Maury Wills.
Yeah, I know, and most people have. But former manager of the Mariners, who? I feel bad for the whole Maury Wills thing, and as part of Mariners history, the Big Book of Baseball Blunders by Rob Neyer puts the hiring of Wills as one of the worst managerial hires in the history of MLB. Now, the problem, and it's right in terms of the record, in terms of the issues that Maury faced, but he was facing his own personal issues at the time and was just not ready because of the struggles that he had with drug addiction and things that were going on in his life. At that time, the job was too big for him, and he lost his way pretty early. And it's one of the disappointing things for me about a great baseball player, shortstop, leader for the Dodgers, but ended up in substance abuse, and that was affecting his job as a manager with the Mariners in the ill-fated year that I don't even remember. He was fired halfway through the year. Things were so bad. He was missing practices and planes. And just,
oh, that's horrible.
And some of the utterances to the media clearly showed, you know, he talked about, well, we're going to be getting so-and-so back here soon, and we're excited about that. And the writer had to say, well, you guys traded him 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
You know, that type of thing. That's what was going on.
Yikes, that's not good.
And then why'd you bring in this pitcher when you knew they'd pinch hit Boog Powell in that situation? And his answer was, well, I was just hoping they wouldn't. I mean, that type of thing. It's unbelievable. And so Maury Wills, who many thought, you know, could have been, should have been the first African-American manager because of his leadership ability. And he'd managed some in winter ball to high accolades that he could get that shot even before Frank Robinson did. He finally got a shot with the Mariners, but he was just not in a good place in his life at the time. But he also, in 1962, this gets back to Easton Talt, he may want to break Travis Bazzano's single-season stolen base record, and if he even gets close or approximates and makes a run at it, then he's having a heck of a year, and well, it'll be a compelling thing to watch.
What was it?
People argue that when Maury chased down Ty Cobb in 62 and reinvented, in a sense, brought back the stolen base, was the MVP of the National League in 62, yes, but people also say his quest to chase down the Georgia peach, Tyrus Raymond Cobb, in his 96, cost the Dodgers the pennant in that, I mean, they ended up blowing a lead late. The Giants came and ended up beating them in a playoff. Wills was so intent that he was stealing bags at inappropriate times, getting thrown out, killing rallies, trying to steal third, get thrown out, that Maury, even though he stole 104, was caught too many times in the pressure of the pennant race and cost his team in the end, in the long run, even though he was the MVP of the league that year. I'm saying Easton Talt will not go Maurice Morning Wills in his quest to chase down Bazzano.
I'd love to see it, but
yeah.
He needs to be playing. He needs to be in the lineup to be able to have those opportunities.
Exactly. Get on base. And get to first.
He has some great, great players in the outfield that, you know, he's got to work around. But
did you do a quick survey?
Yeah, I came up with 19, but that was like a quick
19 what?
Home games.
Home games, yeah. I mean,
that's a quick look. It could
know,
be more.
I have not actually ever studied it. Eugene Horvath, anybody who knows, those of you that know chapter and verse right now, in this 2025 schedule for the Beavers, the rhetorical aspect of the media availability yesterday was Mitch and others saying, yeah, we'll go on the road a lot. We've got a lot of road games coming. But we'll go on the road to play at home in June in the regional and super regionals to Omaha.
Hopefully that'll be the payoff.
Yes.
First home game, March 7th. And that's really about right. Usually they'll go in February, the last week, 10 days of February, which I always say is very wishful thinking because the weather can just be lousy. But, you know, we've had some great series in the month of February. But the first home game against San Diego, March 7th, 8th, and 9th. Then you got Washington State coming in for a couple. Grand Canyon, they're great. Santa Clara. Rutgers, but there's a lot of away games. Neutral games are neutral, yes, but they're not at Goss Stadium in Coleman Field.
No, and neutral requires travel. It looks to me, and I haven't looked at it again. I did my quick count.
Yeah.
I've never really broken it. All I've heard is we're going to be on the road a lot. Nobody spelled out exactly how many. It looks like it could be 35 road, 20 home.
Yeah.
That's a bunch of them, but Mitch also tells me when I was talking to him last year about the 25 schedule, the independent schedule, we'll have a lot of road games next year. He said, on the flip side, we'll have a lot of home games the following year.
Yeah, if you sign home and homes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes, the flip side is this loaded roster, this talented team that Easton just talked about. And I think he's right. I do think 1-9 and the bench and the pitching depth, this is a very good team that can make a deep run. But they're gonna earn their chops certainly through all of these challenges on the road. There's a lot of them.
Yeah, and then being a team that's always with each other and cramped quarters of a locker room and hotels and buses and planes, they are. But they're going to play some really good teams, though, in those neutral sites, really good teams nationally, which, you know, you want to see, and you want to see because you want to get into the NCAA tournament and be a host, and because you're independent, the last thing you want to hear is, well, you didn't play a tough enough schedule.
The schedule's plenty tough enough.
It'll be a little strange at the end, Doc, when everybody's playing in their tournaments,
right,
and Oregon State's not, but
no, I know.
That is the life that it
and
is.
And you build up yourself to a point where that won't matter.
Right.
You know,
sitting there waiting, knowing.
Yeah, and they have done, believe me, they've worked their way through plenty of non-Pac-12 tournament situations to go deep and win national titles. They don't have to have a Pac-12 or a conference tournament of any kind to go where they want to go. They just don't. We have Don McLean coming up in our next segment, then Al Epstein as we're approaching baseball. It's close, but it's still the heart of a really compelling basketball season that takes another step tonight for the Beavs, hosting Pepperdine, then hosting Santa Clara, then playing at Gonzaga on Tuesday. In the triple barrel, or double, we leave Monday and don't get back till Wednesday. And it's not even coming back Tuesday night. So you got three to work things out. Early next week. There's nothing I can do. There's just nothing I can do. Couldn't Roger Bowen? No, couldn't do anything about it. Couldn't be helped. Don McLean next.
The Joe on the air.
22.
What do you mean?
22.
After all the uncertainties of the past 2 years, there's been an expectation and a hope for a more normal 22-23. But now the question is, USC and UCLA do.
They're both Big Ten schools.
Yeah.
But where does that leave the rest of us? Who could possibly answer that question in this strange new era of analytics? bad transfers.
How did it get here?
Well, it looks to me like you portaled it.
A what?
You know, portal from wherever you were to here.
What's that?
It's a different kind of portal. It's just changed so radically, and we're all running to catch up.
And realignments.
They're both big tentacles.
Yep.
All we do know is the boys are back, and the Joe Beaver Show plots its own course.
Now, there are a few more topics that we have to cover. And we will not talk about transfers, and we will not talk about my mother. We will talk about what I want to talk about.
Fair enough. Who's next? Joe Beaver is on 1240 Joe Radio.
Thank you for joining us in our second hour. Al Epstein, 40 years at Pepperdine, joins us at 1230. That alone is worthy of congratulations.
Long time.
And a conversation with the voice of the Pepperdine Waves. He'll join us later in the hour. It is a pleasure to welcome a guy who will be hearing a lot of and seeing the next couple of days. He and J.B. Long working both the Beavers in Pepperdine and the Beavers in Santa Clara from the studios in San Ramon. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the Joe Beaver Show the Pac-12's all-time leading scorer, one of the great players in UCLA history, Don McLean, joins us. Don, good afternoon. How are you today?
I'm great, Mike. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and thanks for coming on. Before we lose the games themselves and working with JB from a studio setting, I want to get to some of the other aspects of your career and your memories of Gil and playing against GP and the Beavers in those days. But first things first, the Beavers in Pepperdine tonight and then the Beavers in Santa Clara. What do you make of these matchups that you're preparing to call with JB?
Well, it's been unusual for me, Mike, just because, you know, we were always the Pac-12. And so I, you know, did probably three or four Oregon State games by now. And so getting a chance to really, you know, lock in and do the prep for a game, I've gotten to learn more about Oregon State. And I think that's been more important than actually who they're playing. I spoke to Wayne yesterday for a while and just getting to know them and how much he likes this group. And the record sure seems to show that games that they're winning this year maybe wouldn't have gone their way in the past. So he likes this group, and I'm happy about that. I'm happy that they're doing well and that Wayne is likes his group and they're winning games. In terms of Pepperdine, I've known Ed Schilling for a long time. Player development guy, was a head coach a long time ago, and now finally he's getting his chance again. I think he's like a lot of coaches, Mike, and I'm sure you talk to a lot of people. The common theme I run into in getting ready for these games and being at shoot-arounds is, you know, just the progression of trying to get to know your team. Everybody's got all these new players every year now, and trying to implement what you want to do and what you want the players to do isn't a preseason thing anymore, and it's really not even a non-con thing anymore. It kind of bleeds into the conference play now, and so I think Ed will get it going at Pepperdine once he starts recruiting and getting the guys he wants in there. But certainly, Mike, a game that Oregon State should win tonight, especially at home.
The following game, though, then becomes, it's a game that the Beavs let slip. I think they had Santa Clara beat and a couple of mistakes late and not getting to a rebound on a missed free throw. I mean, several things happened that cost them a win at Santa Clara. But then Santa Clara goes and beats Gonzaga in Spokane. Santa Clara comes here Saturday. Have you seen enough of or have a feel for Herb Sendek's team and what the Beavers are up against on Saturday in Corvallis?
Well, they're well coached. Herb does a good job, and I think they've, you know, Santa Clara in recent years, Mike, isn't your dad's Santa Clara anymore. They have resources now, and they're operating like a higher major program than what they are. And so I think you're going to continue to see them evolve and ascend. You know, it's been Gonzaga and St. Mary's in the WCC forever, and I think Santa Clara has been below them and with a few other teams, but you just feel like they're closing the gap, Santa Clara, because of the resources, because of their facilities. They're recruiting different kids now than they were a few years ago. So they're a good team. Specifically, I haven't gotten to them yet, Mike, in terms of what they do and what they're going to try and do to beat Oregon State and all that, but I just know that they're operating at a higher level now.
Did you see any of some of the Oregon State victory over Gonzaga? You probably were working your own game, but that's a good win for Wayne and this team. Even if Gonzaga is not quite right now what they have been, that's still a great win. Did you get any kind of feel for how the Beavers did in that one?
I did. I actually watched that game, yeah. Mike. It was one of the nights I wasn't working.
Okay,
I was
good.
Surprised too. I flipped it on. I didn't even know it was on, and then I flipped it. You know, I looked at who was on, and I'm like, great, Oregon State, mm-hmm. Gonzaga. And, that was tremendous in a lot of ways, Mike, just because the building was full.
Mm-hmm.
I know Gonzaga travels, and some of the people were from there, but just the electricity of the environment, even on TV, you could hear it and feel it, that it was a high-level game. I thought the one thing that was interesting to me is, Gonzaga recruits at a different level than Oregon State. They recruit nationally. They have all these top 50 kids on their team. And Mike Ratai was the best player on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
He was. And so it just speaks to Wayne and his staff and their development of players that aren't as highly rated, and maybe high school rankings aren't as accurate as they were before. But just the fact that I could say that Ratai was the best player on the floor when you're playing a team like Gonzaga and how they recruit says a lot.
Now, in terms of how they recruit then, what do you make of the international flavor? Not only, of course, I mean, the Beavers aren't unique in this, but what about Wayne going the international route and the best players from Augsburg, Germany, and LT Lelevichus is from Lithuania and Parsifal from Iran? I mean, what do you make of that as an approach? And it seems to be working for Wayne and Chris Haslam, his assistant right now.
Yeah, and Gonzaga, ironically enough, was kind of at the forefront of that. Mm-hmm. Tommy Lloyd down at Arizona, because he was at Gonzaga, he's doing – everyone's doing it, Mike. Everyone is looking to the international game for players for a couple reasons. One, typically they're more mature. Typically they've learned the game the right way. They weren't brought up in AAU basketball. They were in clubs and schools to play basketball, so they learned the fundamental way to play, so there's not as much – of a learning curve when you bring them into your program. I mean, I was at Oregon the other night, Mike, and Brian Fish has been, one of their assistants has been in Europe for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's becoming that. Everybody is now recruiting Europe. And oh, by the way, the last thing, you don't have to give them NIL money, or you can't give them NIL money. So that's a bonus too.
Don McLean, our guest. Now, you speak of things that lead me. You've touched on Gil being full and the electricity in the building. You as a player coming in saw it that way, did you, in the 89-90 campaign in particular, when the Beavers won the conference with Gary the Player of the Year? I mean, what do you remember about how Gil could rock in those days, Don?
Gil was never not full when I played there. Mm-hmm. Not once. And I guess I played there 4 times, but it was one of my favorite places to play, because I, as you may or may not remember, I kind of fed off of the crowd and being the villain and all that stuff. So the bigger the crowd, the better for me. And so you like that juice. You like the juice of it being loud and it being energetic and it, like it means something. And so I love playing at Oregon State, and I played well at Oregon State. I think Oregon, if I remember this correctly, I haven't looked in 30 years, but I think I averaged the most points a game versus Oregon State than any other Pac-10 team at that time.
Okay. And did you spar with? You weren't afraid of anybody. You backed down from nobody. Did you and Gary get into it a little bit at times?
Well, it's interesting, Mike. I just told this story about a month ago. I forget who I was talking to, but it came up, and you may not remember this. My freshman year, I was already off to a pretty good start, and so Gary, I guess, took note of that. And so from the jump ball, he was in my ear the entire game. Now, my freshman year, I forget what I shot, but at UCLA, I shot 85% at the free throw line. He was in my ear and on me so much in that game, I went 7-for-14 from the free throw line.
Okay. So, but what did you like that, though, Don? You thrive from everything I've read about you in high school and in college and in the NBA. You weren't afraid of anybody, and you'd mix it up. I mean, so.
No, Mike, and that was, I think I wasn't. But I think, first of all, GP was on a different level with that stuff. Like, he might be the best S-talker in the history of the game, literally, at any level. And so, but I also think that game taught me a lot. That if I was going to be the guy, and I'm going to have to take all the incoming, whether it's from Gary Payton or the opposing crowd or whoever it was. But I do remember thinking that okay, if this is how it's going to be, I got to be better, especially at the free throw line.
Don McLean, our guest. Don, you also touched on the fundamental soundness, or a little better in that area for European players. And you said they're not on the AAU circuit. Okay. You have a son, and congratulations to Trent getting an opportunity to play at West Virginia. I mean, that's great. Congratulations to you, to Trent. How did you navigate, if you have a dim view at times of all the jumping around and maybe the less emphasis on fundamentals on the AAU circuit, how did you as a dad and all of that world navigate that?
Well, I think I understand it, and I understand what the AAU is, and it's a vehicle for kids to get in front of coaches and show their stuff. And, you know, athleticism is at the forefront, so if you're a high-level athlete, you're probably getting recruited. You know, I think the one thing for Trent that I can – I have a friend, me and him both, taught Trent how to shoot. And he can really shoot. And I think that – I knew – what it was, what you have to do in the spring and summer and what that looks like and how it's played. But at least when we're on our own, we can figure out how to shoot. And then we can watch film and understand maybe how to play a little bit better and understand the game a little bit more. But it is what it is, Mike. It ain't changing. And unless you want to send your kid to Europe, you're going to have to find a way to get his skill development and his understanding of the game while you're participating in AAU basketball.
Yeah, I have read a story about you, Don, working with a draft camp and a boot camp for draft eligible players that you run and conduct, and that you are a truth teller in those sessions. An article I read in researching to get ready to talk to you today. Do you still do that? How long have you done that? And what is that setting like in terms of trying to get guys to understand what they have to do to play at the next level? And then how did that compare with how you would work with your own son in terms of giving him the truth about where he needs to get better?
Well, they're very similar. I've been doing it for a long time, Mike, probably 19, 20 years now. I work for CAA, which is the biggest basketball agency in the world. And so basically, whoever CAA has going into the draft, they come to me before they go to the combine and the team workouts. And so some years we have 4 or 5. Some years, 1 year we have 13. So it's different every year. This year we're going to have Cooper Flagg, which I'm excited about. But it's similar. And I have basically 8 weeks to start the process. I can't get everything done in 8 weeks that needs to be done. But our plan is, that the first priority is to try and get them drafted as high as we can. But then secondly, get them ready for summer league. And so each player obviously comes in with a different skill set, different position. And so we drill down on what we need to get now, what we need to get rid of now that they have, and just try and clean them up and get them so that when they go to these team workouts, they are giving these teams more than what they saw in person or what they saw on film. But it's high intensity, high level. We go 6 days a week for 8 weeks. And we get a lot done. It's just 8 weeks isn't long enough to fix everything.
And then how would you say you are as an instructor and a coach in that kind of setting while also working with your sons in settings to help them be the best they can be?
Well, it's different with your sons, obviously. And I have people that help me. And so as they've gotten older, I got them early and I coached a lot of their teams early. But once they got older, I have guys that I trust that have worked with me for a while that understand what I want and what I see. And so they work out with them more than me. I watch and, you know, give my 2 cents every once in a while. But I think you said it before we started talking about this, Mike. I don't BS anybody. It's the truth. And here's who you are. Here's what you need to get. Here's what you need to get rid of. And you need to get in better condition, everybody. And so that's why I say it's high level, high intensity, because we got a small window to go. Because some of these guys, like Jaime Jaquez, we had a couple of years ago, he worked out for 16 teams before the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got to be ready for that. And so we get them ready for that.
Final thing, Don, and that is the I'm so glad we're getting you and JB. That's an A team for our games this weekend. And back in the Pac-12 footprint, you and Ted Robinson. Ted told us about a podcast you're doing, kind of keeping your foot in the Pac-12 door, but you're doing a lot of Big Ten stuff as a Big Ten analyst. And at your alma mater, Mick Cronin has been on a rhetorical roll here of late with his post-game, almost can't miss press conferences. And you wonder, what's he going to say this time? What have you made of it? And he used the word delusional in talking about his own players. They're delusional about how hard they think they're working or whatever else he was talking about. What do you make of that and what Mick's been up to?
I've gotten to know Mick pretty well since he's been at UCLA, Mike. And I think, and I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but I do know this, that I think that he's frustrated with all of it. I think he's frustrated that there's conference realignment. I think he's frustrated with the travel that comes with conference realignment. I think he's frustrated with paying players NIL money. I think he's frustrated with a lot of things because it's hard right now to be a high major D1 coach. It is. There's so much different responsibility than what they signed up for 20 or 30 years ago in terms of raising money and roster construction and recruiting high school players, but also recruiting the transfer portal. And so it's a lot. And I just think that, you know, this is new. I think he and the four schools that went to the Big Ten will eventually settle in, but it's been a change this year. It's been a change for me. You know, I'm used to doing the Pac-12 travel, and I'm not going to the Midwest, but I'm only going to Oregon and Washington and SC and UCLA, so that's different. And I have to get to know Illinois and Maryland and Purdue when they come out this way. And so it's all evolving. It's all changing, and it seems more difficult, and we'll see in a couple of years what everyone's saying. But right now, it's just a lot of new moving parts, and I think it makes it uneasy for a lot of people. Yeah. But I'll always, as long as the Pac-12, Mike, is going to be a thing, I'm always going to be connected to it. I may not do as many games as I once did. Like, I was doing 50 a year for 12 years. But I'm going to stay connected to it because I feel strongly about the people that stayed with it and have kept it together at Washington State and Oregon State, but at the conference level, our facility in San Ramon, the people that have kept that place going. And in 2 years, it's going to be a pretty good basketball league, Mike. It is. Gonzaga's coming in, San Diego State, Utah State. It's going to be a good basketball league. And I think for all of us that were in the Pac-12 for as long as we were, it's going to be different. But the people aren't going to change much, at least the people that are running things. And I'm excited about that.
Don, thank you so much. I'm glad to hear you say that. Thanks for keeping those fires burning for the conference and having such a high view of it as we go forward. I hope our paths will cross again. Hope you and JB have good broadcast this weekend together from the studios. And I hope to talk to you down the road. Thanks again for your time, Don. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no doubt, Mike. Thanks.
Don McLean, the conference's all-time leading scorer. Gary at a different level and the all-time S talker at any level, he says, of the history of the game. That could indeed be true.
What I've heard.
7-for-14. That's the old, how did Aaron Rodgers do against the Beavers in 2003 in Berkeley? Huh? How about 52 yards? 9-for-34, 52 yards. Don McLean at Gill, 7-for-14. But it sounded as though he learned and got revenge in future games in the building. Great stuff from Don McLean. I mean, just one of the best. Great analyst. I like what he said at the end about believing in the Pac-12 and the conference and the future. And that's why he and Ted are doing a Pac-12 kind of podcast and keeping their eye on the Beavs and the Cougs. And he'll have his eyes all weekend on these games on ESPN+.
Well, infrastructure-wise, the Pac-12 right now is at its lowest point. It's only going to get bigger. It's only going to get better. They're going to use these facilities. They'll have more TV games. The Pac-12 will have at least 8 teams, maybe more, and start to compete. And he's right. The basketball teams that are coming in are pretty good.
Yeah, it's going to be a really good league. And we'll see who else gets added to kind of complete things. But no matter what, even if you didn't add anybody else.
No, Gonzaga,
right now,
Utah State, San Diego State, Oregon State, Washington State.
Yeah.
Fresno State,
right?
That's 6 teams right now, you think, has a great history of basketball.
Let's break and come back with Al Epstein. Now, he's a gentleman.
Should we talk it up for another 2 minutes and then break back?
Yeah, we'll be bringing him back after the quick timeout here on the Joe Beaver Show. Now, tomorrow, Don's partner, J.B. Long, will join us. I'm not sure what else we're going to do. We're working on some other things. We were Lost in the 60s yesterday afternoon. I don't know if anybody did any follow-up on any level on Super Bowl III and the fix, but we were lost in the 60s with apologies to Ronnie, who was lost in the previous decade.
That was we'll come amazing. Back.
I enjoyed the conversation yesterday. We'll come back with Al Epstein next on The Joe Beaver Show. We continue on The Joe Beaver Show. Mike Parker with John Warren. The Beavers play Pepperdine tonight at Gill Coliseum at 6:30. I'll be on the air at 6 down the table. Just to know that I'll be working at the same table with a guy who's in his 40th season as the voice of the Pepperdine Waves. And I have it in my notes here somewhere, but I got to dig it out again. I believe tonight will mark the 1,212th consecutive game. I may be one off.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Okay, 12 consecutive games that our next guest will be calling. That in itself, to me, that's one of the great streaks and records I've ever come across in getting ready for a ball game to call on our own end. Al Epstein, the voice of Pepperdine, joins us on The Joe Beaver Show. Al, all I can say is congratulations. Welcome back to Corvallis. You've been here before, but wow, how have you done it? 8 years without missing a game all these years.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me on. You know, I wake up every morning and kind of just say to myself, how did I get here? So it's pretty amazing going back to the 1980s. I have been at Gill Coliseum, and I've been to Oregon State a number of times. So yeah, a little bit of luck, I guess, trying to stay healthy. You know, there's been times when I've had a wrenched neck and lost my voice and missed airplanes, but it's all worked out. Somehow I seem to show up for every game. There was one game I think I was doing up at Santa Barbara. I literally sat down 15 minutes before tip-off. So there's been some close calls, but I've been really fortunate. So, yeah, it's been an incredible streak. Yeah, they keep reminding me. I keep trying to forget.
Well, no, I got you. I mean, the memories you've built, but it's one of the first notes you see, and I'm grateful for that. I mean, it's right that in the Pepperdine notes and release, that's up there front and center, and it should be. Al, the late, great Chick Hearn, who you probably met and knew a little bit in the Southland somewhere along the way, but I grew up listening to him when I was very young in the late 60s and early 70s. But I love Chickie, who also had an amazing streak, but he did miss two games in his long Laker career. I think he missed two, and he told of the circumstances, one of which a pilot saying, we can't get up in this fog, and Chick says, if the pilot says it, that's good enough for him. So and so he missed two games in that incredible career of his with the Lakers. Have you missed flights and had to drive or had weather issues that made you have to drive or what over this streak?
Yes, exactly. I we're doing a game, I think, in Iowa at the University of Iowa, and we're in Chicago, and we couldn't get in, so we had to stay overnight. Fortunately, the game, I left the day early, so I was able to catch a morning flight the next day. But other than that, for the most part, no real close calls trying to get to a game. You know, we try to plan ahead, but you never really know in a situation going to a game. And so, yeah, so far so good with Gilvin. Hope the streak continues.
Al Epstein, our guest. Hi, Al. This is John with Mike. And tonight's broadcast, of course, Oregon State and Pepperdine. Just looking through your bio, so many different sports that you have done. Polo sticks out for me. I'd love to know more about that. But have you been concentrating on mostly basketball of late, or are you still branching out and doing all these other things?
Well, I still do a lot of other sports. I actually still broadcast polo, which I've been doing for 30 years. And that's, by the way, horses, mallets, and plastic balls. Unfortunately, with all the with the fires raging on in Palisades, and that's where we do the polo matches at Will Rogers State Park. And from what I've heard, it's completely burned down. The ranch house that's been there for like 75, 80 years, the announcer's booth, the barns, the fencing, everything is gone. So, and we do that during the summertime, broadcasting polo from around early May all the way until October. So, so with that being said, it's kind of a dark note regarding that. But, yeah, I still do, for Pepperdine, I still do men and women's volleyball. I do their women's soccer. I do their baseball games. I'll do some of the women's basketball games in Las Vegas during the tournament. But all along, it's really been doing the men's basketball over the years, you know, going back to the 1980s. So, you know, you have to make yourself as versatile as you possibly can and make yourself as valuable as you can. So hopefully the university appreciates that. And so if they decide to fire me one day, it's going to leave a big void in their broadcasting.
Sure.
Al Epstein joining us, the voice of the Pepperdine Waves. John and I were talking yesterday about the how every school that we prepare for, it seems as though if you go to USF, you end up reading about the 60-game win streak, and certainly Gonzaga and Santa Clara and other schools. Everybody has had a moment in time or a run, and certainly you've been part of, as the voice for 40 years, the best of times with Pepperdine basketball. What can you tell us about the streak that you guys had under Tom Asbury? That is it still the record for the longest win streak in the WCC in conference play?
Well, it was 30. I think it's something like 38 consecutive wins home and away. But I think Gonzaga may have broken it. It's been such a long time ago. Tom Asbury coached way back in the 80s and early 1990s. It was an incredible streak. It actually had broken San Francisco's streak of consecutive conference wins, which is no easy task, especially nowadays, this year in the conference. But those were great days. You know, they had a great player, Doug Christie, and was a top player back in the early 1990s. Dana Jones, even players like Bert Avery, but he played way back in the 1970s when he led the nation in scoring. So, and Dennis Johnson, he was back there, I think, in the 80s. So, so a long time ago, but it was an incredible streak at the time. And I think Gonzaga has broken. I'm not 100% sure on that, but it was a great run. And, you know, Jim Herrick was the head coach there. We've had a lot of terrific coaches over the years, and, you know, Jim Herrick and Vance Wahlberg, who now is at Fresno State, is the head coach there, and Jan Van Bredekoff and just Gary Colson, Paul Westfall have come through there over the years. So there's a lot of history with that university.
No question about it. And you've worked with a lot of fine coaches. John, you had a question?
Yeah. Speaking of history, and you just as you were talking there, Al, I just thought of this. I know you're not even close to being old enough, but in the early days when you were there, or even through time of being in the West Coast Conference, how much chatter has there been about back when the league had football? It was many years ago, but does that conversation ever come up over the time you've been with Pepperdine?
Well, certainly not lately, but when I first started, which was back in the mid-1980s, Pepperdine did drop the football program, I think around 1960. It's been a while, so even before then, a good 20 years before I got there. So every now and then somebody might bring it up, and I think their last year they were 10-0 in their final season. So, but, you know, because of the expenses and being a smaller school, it's kind of difficult to maintain football, as most of the schools in Southern California have dropped the sport. A lot of the state schools like Cal State Northridge and Cal State Fullerton, and really it's just USC and UCLA in Southern California with football. But, you know, they didn't have the TV income that they've got now, so maybe that might have changed things. At a lower level, but every now and then it might come up, but for the most part, it's pretty much what's going on today.
The voice of the Pepperdine Waves, Al Epstein, our guest here on the Joe Beaver Show. Al, we came across an article in preparing to visit with you. John found it that I found intriguing, in that you co-authored a book entitled Play-by-Play Sportscast Training, and it's described here as one of the first and only play-by-play texts. Now, my question is, because it feels as though all of us who end up gravitating to this, we did so because we heard people on the radio or whatever that excited and inspired us to want to do the same thing. And as I grew up as a kid, I thought, that's my training. That's my... There's no, how can there be a manual or a textbook about it? But you did endeavor to write one. So what was your approach with that book in terms of trying to impart some fundamentals, some techniques to try to get into the business and prosper in it, so to speak?
Well, it's exactly, it is all about the fundamentals of play-by-play. And we do talk about that during the course of the book. It was written in the early 1990s, so the internet wasn't even invented back then. It was just radio and television. But, you know, we had the same co-author with a friend of mine, Lou Riggs, who since passed away a number of years ago. And he helped me about working how to prepare for a broadcast. I remember the first time I did a game with him. It was a junior college football game at Santa Monica College, and I showed up with a pen, and that was about it. And he had he opened up a briefcase that had 50 pages of notes, and I said, this is not good. So I was pretty bad when at the end of the game, and I said to him, I said, you know, I think I need to prepare a little bit more. And he goes, yeah, you do. So that kind of let me know, well, I'm on the wrong track here. So I had to turn things around. And, you know, it was something with people like yourself growing up and wanted to learn broadcasting and sportscasting. We had nothing to go by. So we thought, well, let's write a textbook with just the fundamentals of how to do it, how to prepare, how to do an interview, sports boards, things like that. It's all in the book. You know, it's at playbysportscasttraining.com. It's still there. We still sell it. So it's something that for somebody younger, just starting out, it's a great fundamental text for somebody who wants to go into sports casting, whether you want to do color commentary or play-by-play. But, yeah, we had the same question. You know, we didn't have anything to go by when we were growing up and learned how to do broadcasting and sports casting. So we just felt, well, let's write this book and see what happens. And so we still sell it. It's still good. And, you know, it's still out there. So, and the price has never changed, by the way, since the 1990s. It's still the same price.
Very nice. Was Chick Hearn your guy?
I never met the man, unfortunately, but obviously I followed him. He's really one of the greats of his day. I think, as you mentioned, his streak, it was something like over 3,000 games that he did consecutively until he missed maybe a game or two. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, he was doing 100 games plus, where we only do about 30, sure. 35. But I followed him along with others like Dick Enberg in football and the Angels baseball went on to go national. Bob Miller was a great play-by-play for hockey and just a number of other guys. So, yeah, I mean, those guys had great influence on me growing up. So, yeah, no, you never forget those guys.
Al, final thing, and this is something John and I talk about since we're both in the business and have done a lot of play-by-play over the years. Does your book purport to give some basics in terms of rules that no matter whether you're Dick Enberg or Bob Miller or Vin Scully or Al Epstein or whomever, this is what everybody has got to do? I mean, are there rules that still apply? The fundamental things apply as time goes by in the sportscasting world.
Well, that's a great question. And when we wrote the book, that was the intention, that the fundamentals will always stay the same. So even so, it was written back in the early 1990s and was published in 1992. The fundamentals still remain the same. You know, scoring time, where's the ball, location, and things like that. So that's never really changed, and that was our intent when we, you know, when we wrote the book. It took us about 6 months, and you know, you write and rewrite things like that and go over it. And so, the fundamentals really never changed. At least we don't think so when we wrote the book, and I still follow those same fundamentals, you know, when I do a broadcast. And even when we do the ESPN Plus or the Big Ten Plus now that the team is on volleyball, we just still follow the same rules. And I still kind of do the games, even when it's a TV game or a video streaming game, I still call it like it's a radio game.
Yeah.
Did you ever, okay, I'm going to add one last question to the last question. Did you ever change, though, your feelings on some basics? And here's what I mean. I think an absolute should be you give the score going to break and you give the score coming back from break because too many guys don't give the score at all. But that should be a fundamental, number one. Number two, the analyst should never be a fan and screaming over you when you're trying to call play-by-play because they're so happy that their team is doing something well. Those two things are happening today. Did you ever change in your passion for, no, this is how this should be? Because the more we talk about those two things that I just mentioned, we'll get callers and people saying, what's the big deal?
Well, no, you're exactly right. Times have changed, and it does go back to the fundamentals. You know, I think Vin Scully, of course, the great Dodger announcer, for 60 some odd years. So, I think I still have another 20 years to go because he went 60 some odd years.
Right.
So, but you know, I used to say if you're rooting for your team, and you kind of lose credibility and believability if you do that. We are going to win this game or whatever it might be. So that's something you always want to stay neutral. Of course, you want your team to win, but when you're on the air, you have to be kind of right down the middle of the road. And so that's the way we've always approached it. I think we mentioned that in the course of the textbook. And then you're exactly right. When you're going to an LQ, you always mention the score and time, or at least visually you'll see it on the screen. And then when you come back in, because people might come and go, you never leave your audience taken for granted. So when you come back in after a commercial, you always give the score and time. And those are fundamentals that we always talk about. So that never really changes. A lot of that stuff is neglected nowadays. And the commentators every now and then do get carried away, and they really need to control themselves, and they tend to ramble a little bit too much sometimes when the game's going on, so they have to be reminded about that. I think the rule of thumb is when you're doing the color commentating, when the ball gets into the front court on either side, just kind of wrap it up what you want to say, and then let the game play itself out.
Al Epstein, the voice of the Pepperdine Waves. One thought on the game tonight. You have a new coach succeeding Lorenzo Romar. You've worked with a lot of coaches clearly in your 40 years, and really good coaches and people. Ed Schilling is in his first year. What's he been like to work with, and what kind of team is he bringing into Corvallis tonight and hoping, in a sense, to build as he gets his era rolling?
Well, he's been great. He's a really conscientious coach. Listen, he knows his X's and O's. He understands the game. He's been coaching for over 30 years. He's worked with John Calipari for 13 years in Memphis and UMass and with the Brooklyn Nets. He's worked for Steve Alford at UCLA and Tom Crean at Indiana. He was at Bryce Drew the last 4 years. So he brings a lot of experience. And again, he's been great to work with. He's very conscientious about when we're doing the talk shows and things like that. Our pregames. But, the thing is about Pepperdine this year, they have had so many injuries, and two of their starters who they were counting on, two guards, one's a four-star recruit from Wake Forest, hasn't played 1 second this year, doesn't appear he's going to play the rest of the season. And then another guard who played 4 years at Marist, he hasn't played 1 second either. So you take two starters out of that lineup, and then other players have been injured during the course of this season. So that's kind of set them back. But with that being said, they've got a lot of size, a lot of big international presence, like Oregon State. So they've got size, they've got experience. I don't think there's an NBA player on this roster, but they have a lot of good, mid-level players that I thought and have been very competitive during the course of the season. So it'll be interesting. They've got a really good guard in Mo Odom, who's sixth in the nation in assists per game, and Stefan Todorovic, who's second leading scorer in the conference at just under 19. So they've got a lot of players, a lot of pieces, but with those two players, they need other players to step up, and those players are a little bit younger. Jackson Overa, a freshman, has stepped up and played pretty well. He actually had 27 against Gonzaga a couple weeks ago. So they need the other players to step up, and I hope it'll be a competitive game. They're not real deep on the bench this year, but because of the injuries, but they've been as competitive as they probably could be.
Al, it is a real pleasure and honor to talk to somebody getting ready to call his 1,212th consecutive game tonight, bringing you to Corvallis. And Gil, glad you made the flight and everything and safely in to our beautiful part of the world. We look forward to coming to your place, too. Thank you so much for your time, Al. It's great talking to you, and hope we can do it again.
All right. Thanks, Mike, John. I appreciate it. We'll see you later tonight.
Thanks a lot, Al. Al Epstein, 40 years in, the voice of the Waves. We wrap up the show next for today on the Joe Beaver Show. The thing I want to know is how they do it. You know, when we talk about conspiracies, and I remember Dana Carvey's very good bit on Saturday Night Live or elsewhere about the framing of O.J. and how it was just too good and how they had to do it. And yeah, no, we've got to frame O.J. it's a funny bit that Dana Carvey did back in the day. But I'd like to have somebody tell me how the baseball writers in terms of there's only been one, and I find that surprising, only one in the history, the Baseball Writers Association of America. Our own Ron Callan, maybe we'll get him on tomorrow. Ron, amongst his many claims, says that he did the first interview with Ichiro in Seattle. And Ron's probably telling us the truth. He's had these oddities and quirky things and milestones in his career. And he's probably telling the truth when he says, I did the first interview with Ichiro when Ichiro arrived in Seattle.
So we'll
get
that
story. Okay. That's not one. You know, but any subject comes up, and so Ron and I were texting back and forth the other day. He said, I see Ichiro made the Hall. I did the first interview with him in Seattle. That was sort of his text to me and talking about other things as well. This week's Beaver Sports podcast that Ron has done, heavy baseball with Wilson Weber, Mitch Canham, and Joey Munt. Those are the featured players on this week's Beaver Sports podcast. Good listening, good interviews, good stuff as we get ready for baseball. We had Easton Tault on today. But the question that I had was, how do they do it? Does somebody get designated, and how did they miss out on Mariano in 2019? According to your quick research on ChatGPT, right? I think it's true, though. There's only been one unanimously selected Hall of Fame player that all the writers voted. Ichiro missed one vote, 393 out of 394. One writer left him off the ballot. Larry Stone at the Seattle Times, and Larry back in the day went on a quest to find out the three who didn't vote for Ken Griffey Jr. Mm-hmm. Ken Griffey Jr. was not a unanimous Hall of Famer, nor was, and this is where Ken shouldn't get too worked up, nor was Babe Ruth. Nor was Ty Cobb, nor was Joe DiMaggio, nor was Hank Aaron, nor was Willie Mays. Until Mariano Rivera in 2019, there had never been a unanimous Hall of Famer named on every ballot. And now Ichiro misses. How do they do it? Did the writers send it? I mean, how do they decide, okay, I'll be the one this year not to vote for Willie Mays?
Major conspiracy.
I mean, how does it happen? Has anybody ever written about that and talked about it? Yesterday, we were trying to break down the fix in Super Bowl III. Today, I'm just trying to figure out how could only one time, and I love Mariano Rivera, but how can he be the only guy above Willie and above Joe and above Ted and above the Bambino
Hank
and above
Aaron.
Hank Aaron? Mariano Rivera doesn't deserve to be the only guy that's ever been. I mean, he's great, but he's not greater than the guys I just talked about.
No, not even close. No, and it begs the question if they get together. But
well, yeah, how does it happen?
I mean, it's been going on for so long. I don't.
But why didn't it happen in 2019? I mean, how does Mariano get to be the guy?
That's the great mystery.
I mean, he's the greatest closer the game's ever known, but don't tell me that he's a greater force in baseball than a bunch of the guys I just and will continue
like
to mention.
Willie
and the
Mays.
Bambino and Joe and Willie and Hank and
Ted
Williams.
That is a great question. That is, it happens all the time when there's one or two votes, two or three votes
shy. How does it happen?
I don't think they talk. That much I know. I mean,
they just trust, hey, one of us will do the right thing and not vote for him?
To keep it alive.
But Mariano's the outlier. Well, why him?
Let me ask you this. Do you know if it's if it's...
No, they don't have to disclose the ballots.
So you can be anonymous.
No, yeah. Larry Stone tried, and the guy that didn't vote for Ichiro, we don't know who it is. Ichiro says he'd like to talk to him and buy him a drink and talk it over. That's what Ichiro's response was.
Because I can see someone saying that no one deserves to be a first ballot.
Or unanimous or first ballot?
No, just first ballot. Yeah. Just saying, next year or whenever the rotation is.
There's been a lot of first ballot guys, though, that do. I mean, that's the phrase. He's a first ballot Hall of Famer.
That's the only thing I can think of.
But except Mariano. And again, why him? If you're going to make an exception once in life and get every voter, why a relief pitcher? I mean, come on. Mariano was unbelievable at his craft, but come on. Don't make a relief pitcher the only unanimous Hall of Fame inductee have Willie and the Babe sitting back there without that.
The people voting now, though, weren't alive. They weren't voting for Babe and Hank Aaron and Willie Mays. So there was a different set of conspiracy people back then.
I'm just curious if anybody out there has read an article about it. That may be something I'll run by Rob Nyer off the air someday just to say, Rob, you're our guy that knows everything.
Yeah.
How in the world, and Kip, if you know, send us a quick text. If Brooks Hatch, what? How does it happen? But why, bigger than that is, how can you have one outlier and it be Mariano? As great as he was.
Glennie's saying here that I didn't know this, yeah, that Ohio State wasn't unanimous number one in the AP poll. Some joker voted for Oregon. Is that true?
Well, that's interesting. I guess so. I don't know. But, I mean, I can see almost on principle there are people grousing about Ohio State being a national champion with two losses.
It doesn't matter if there's a playoff system and you get through it, you're the champion.
I know, but it does matter in that in 2003, Pete Carroll and the Trojans didn't play in the BCS title game.
Right.
But the AP voted them. The AP writers named USC the
right,
number
one
team.
And LSU was the other national right. champion. That's never been a problem, though. LSU people say, we've got it. USC people say, we've got it. And over here, we say USC got it. And, you know, there hasn't been any fights over it. It's just kind of a thing that is. I'll say, though, that this is almost proof that it's good that they made a playoff and played it on the field, because you can say that Ohio State is the national champion. If
yes, you can.
This person voted Oregon, then if it were just an AP vote like it was 50 right. years ago, right. maybe Ohio State gets mm-hmm. gets jobbed out of that, mm-hmm. even though, well, they probably would have with two losses. They absolutely would have.
Well, in the old format, they wouldn't even make the playoff, the
right.
four-team playoff. The two or the four, and they wouldn't have made it. Now they're the national champion. Again, does that argue that they are the most deserving by winning four games or the least by winning it with two?
No, I think if you, as in the sport of football, can get through those four extra games and beat the quality of teams that they
beat were good.
And do it in the fashion that they did, you deserve every accolade you get for being a national champion.
Still hoping, if any of you have ever looked into it, I really haven't. It's not something to get too exercised about, although I am a little bit about the one outlier more than anything else. Somehow, some way, writers have never, until 19 with Rivera, had a unanimous Hall
That's
of
amazing,
Famer.
Especially yeah, considering how many years.
Consider the years and the players involved that didn't make it as a unanimous selectee. Somebody left Willie Mays and Babe Ruth and Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams off their ballots. Hank Aaron.
Those are the ones I want to go talk
to. That, to me, then, the most puzzling thing is the one exception to it is a relief pitcher. The best ever, but not in any way, in my view, deserving to be in the same breath as the players that I just talked about.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Anyhow,
it's something to talk about.
I'm just know how there's it just feels like there's got to be some sort of who's going to be the one not to vote for Willie Mays?
Yeah,
this
like
year?
They talk
or Ken Griffey Jr. Well,
easier now with the internet, you can communicate. I don't know that they did that 100 years ago.
Hey, thanks everybody. Thanks to Easton Tall, to Don McLean, to Al Epstein. We'll see you at Gill tonight. And we'll have J.B. Long and maybe another tomorrow.